Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Last week we aired the first of two interviews with the principals involved in the creation of a new opera, The Trial of Standing Bear, by Opera Omaha. The actual trial took place in 1879 in Omaha, Nebraska, and resulted in a federal judge declaring for the first time that Native Americans are persons under the law and that the government had no legal authority to remove them from their homelands. Last week we spoke to Jane Hill, who wrote the libretto. In a moment, we'll talk to composer Brent Michael Davids. But first, let's take a look at an important event from this week in history. During this week in 1950, a high-ranking United Nations official, Ralph Bunche, became the first African-American to win the Nobel Peace Prize. After losing both of his parents by the age of 13, Bunche's intellectual prowess and determination led him to become class valedictorian at the University of California, Los Angeles. Bunche gained national attention by denouncing President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal for its unequal treatment of black citizens, and determined to act on this injustice, he took his expertise in colonial development to the State Department. In 1947, after serving just 3 years as a delegate to various UN conferences around the world, Bunche received the prestigious chair of the UN Special Committee on Palestine, from which he juggled disagreements on land allotments between hostile Palestinians and Jews. When war broke out in 1948, he served as a UN mediator to negotiate an armistice between Israel and the Arab states, for which in 1950 he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. For the rest of his life, Ralph Bunche remained a powerful voice in the civil rights movement. And in 1963, President John Kennedy awarded him the nation's Medal of Freedom. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, through negotiations with the family of Martin Luther King, Jr., Congress hopes to add the slain civil rights leader's papers to their impressive collection of the American heritage. Sotheby's Auction House estimated the value of the historic papers at $30 million, but King's wife and children have agreed to part with them for about $10 million less. According to Library of Congress spokeswoman Jill Brett, the papers would join the likes of papers written by presidents and Supreme Court justices and be the most expensive acquisition ever. However, Brett added, King was one of the century's great figures. Hollywood icons Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn will sail again, sort of. As a result of a recent purchase made by a former Kentucky attorney, the African Queen, the boat that the two movie stars sailed on in the 1951 movie of the same title, is now offering half-hour cruises on the Saginaw River for a mere $15. James Hedricks, the new owner of the boat, claims to have asked Katharine Hepburn if she would ever ride on the antique artifact again. According to Hendricks, Hepburn responded with a start saying, "I thought it blew up in Africa." You're listening to Talking History. Welcome back to Talking History. This week's interview is the second in our two-part exploration of the use of history in opera, or to be more specific, the use of history in a new opera by Opera Omaha, The Trial of Standing Bear, that has just begun production. Last week we talked to Jane Hill, Opera Omaha's executive director who wrote the libretto. This week we're pleased to have with us composer Brent Michael Davids, who has written the music for the opera. Davids is an internationally known composer. He's classically trained, but he's also a member of the Mohican Indian Nation, and his work has been described as reflecting both Western compositional techniques and elements of American Indian music. His work has been performed by such groups as the Joffrey Ballet, the National Symphony Orchestra, and the Boston Symphony. Welcome, Brent.
Hi.
Brent, explain to us this mix that has been used to describe your music of Western and Indian elements.
Well, mostly it's a mix on several different levels. On one level, traditionally for Native tribes, there is really no conceptual category of music at all for traditional Natives. Music is a very Western concept. It's more compartmentalized. It's a piece of what tribes would consider part of something else, a whole, a dance, a ceremony, and music is not conceptually separated from those events the same way it is in the West. So when I'm mixing the elements, I'm dealing with, on the one hand, something which is very narrowly defined as music, and then on the other hand, a more holistic experience of song and dance and ceremony, in which I'm only, you know, dealing with small parts of something else.
Okay, now this is not new. I was surprised in preparing this to read about other composers in the past that have tried to work in indigenous elements, and yet you seem to receive a great deal of praise for having a particular sympathy or understanding, perhaps coming from your heritage, your lineage. Would you care to comment, maybe unfair, on some composers in the past that have tried to use this tradition and what has happened?
Well, I have the advantage of writing from the inside perspective. You know, there's been a whole history of people borrowing or being inspired by Native music all the way as far back as Rameau, who's credited, I think, in the Enlightenment period of writing music. He went to in Louisiana area or whatever. He saw a couple Native dancers dancing and went back to Europe and wrote a couple parts of a ballet, one's called Le Sauvage, and the Savages, and then the Gallant Indian are parts of a ballet. And basically, they're just sort of a waltz in a minor key on harpsichord. So they don't sound at all Native, but that was sort of his borrowed inspiration of the idea. And several other composers have done, you know, Dvorak and some other composers. But, being the insider, I mean, in a very basic way, only Natives can do Native music because we have a responsibility to the tribes, to our people. In other words, the music I write, I'm responsible for personally, but I'm also responsible to a whole tribe of relatives who are looking over my shoulder. And there's just no way a non-Native composer can be that responsible. You know, there are songs that, ritual songs that were maybe collected and recorded by early ethnologists floating around there. So they probably should not have been recorded in the first place. And then here comes, you know, some non-Native composer who goes through the, you know, the field recordings available today and maybe uses that song. And then you hear the song for, you know, cello and piano. It should not have been used in the first place and probably should not have been recorded in the first place. So it's like a mistake compounded by another mistake compounded by another mistake. Okay.
Well, let's see how that works. We have a piece here from your first symphony, which will debut in December in New Mexico, Powwow, A Gathering of Nations. We'll listen to a piece, and I'll ask you to comment on it.
Great.
So what's Western and what's Indian?
Well, I'd just go on the record and say that that was all 100% Brent Michael David's. But it's influenced in both Native influences and Western. Of course, it's Western instruments, you know, violins and orchestra instruments, as well as some Native percussion instruments. And it's basically an adagio, which is sort of a kind of a form from Western orchestra music. And the rhythms, though, are Native. It's a very slow heartbeat pattern that was going on in that movement. It's just the heartbeat, you know, boom, 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 boom. but in Western music, I think the closest approximation would be kind of a five-count beat, like where the accents are on one and three. So it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, boom, 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 boom. That's kind of the heartbeat pattern. And you heard that as well in this little movement.
Okay, now you mentioned Western instrumentation. You play the crystal flute. Do you do that because it best exemplifies Indian qualities, or maybe you should describe the instrument first?
Right. It's a flute made out of quartz crystal, and it was developed first by Michael Wheeler and myself, and then later by Don Galvin. I've actually shattered three of them, so I'm playing crystal flute number 4, and I have number 5 in backup now. I learned to keep a spare. But it's actually a mix. It's traditional for flute players, native flute players, to play flute. They make their own flutes and then perform on them as solo instruments. They're usually not with accompanying instruments. And my flute is sort of a mix. It's a transverse flute, or you blow across the hole on the side of the instrument, similar to a Western metal, you know, orchestral flute. But then it only has 6 holes on the side of it, so it's essentially like tuned like a native flute would be tuned. And so it's actually a hybrid, kind of a mix of both worlds.
Okay, well, maybe we should listen to it in our next piece, Indian Killer, and then you can describe where that comes from.
Sure.
Lovely instrument. Tell us about Indian Killer. What's that about?
Indian Killer is a soundtrack from 2 scenes that I composed for Robert Redford's Sundance Film Institute. They've been running directors' laboratories and screenwriters' laboratories where those people go and work on with professionals in the area. And last summer, they started the first composer's laboratory. So I went and worked with professional composers in L.A. and learned how to score for film. And the emphasis is not on learning to compose. I mean, you're assuming the composers going to the lab know how to compose. The idea was to learn what composers are supposed to score for film, how to write music in and out of dialogue and to help, you know, move a scene along when it needs it, or create mood music for a particular film. And this was music from Sherman Alexie's upcoming film called Indian Killer, which is taken from the novel Indian Killer. And his first movie, of course, was Smoke Signals, which is out on Miramax now.
Right. That was a good film. You're here to do Trial of Standing Bear. What attracted you to this story?
What attracted me to it is that it's a story of basic human rights for Native Americans, where Standing Bear is really the first test case for the court system to decide whether natives are actually people or not. Before that, you know, we were not considered people. We were romanticized in the, you know, in the 1900s, and, you know, when Thoreau was, you know, romanticizing the natural environment, so to speak, or that, you know, natives became sort of noble. But earlier time periods in the early colonies, like in Massachusetts and the colonies, nature was seen as somewhat evil. You know, it was a very harsh environment, and people living out in nature, you know, i.e. Native Americans, were also considered evil and devils. If you look through the Winthrop journals and some other early writings, you can find all sorts of references to natives as sort of devilish creatures running around there. But Standing Bear is the first case where, you know, the course had to decide, you know, are we people or not?
The trial takes place in 1879, so we're talking about an historical event here. How do you compose an opera? Does it make any difference that it's an historical event?
Well, it does and it doesn't. I mean, in one sense, we're producing a piece of performance here, you know, so that it needs to have drama, and the music is partly underscoring, you know, from what I'm concerned with. So I want to write music that's halfway, you know, or somewhat familiar to the audiences now listening to it. At the same time, I wanted to capture some kind of historical flavor for the opera itself and also the characters. So I've been listening to a lot of Ponca music and listening to Ponca language, and I'm trying to capture that flavor in the work itself. And then going through the different characters and trying to figure out what music from their particular character background might sound like, and incorporating those ideas into the...
Give us an example of how you did that, maybe with Standing Bear, for example.
Standing Bear, what I did was I tried to create an aria for him. He gives this famous speech in the courtroom where he's basically appealing to the judge to decide, you know, in favor of letting him live as a free person and not forcing him to go live on the reservation. And I developed it as a trio, basically because I wanted to capture, again, the same idea that natives feel a responsibility to their communities. We don't live essentially as autonomous individuals, in a sense. We are a part of a collective tribe. So when I thought of writing his aria, I wanted to have other voices in there. So the beginning of the aria for him is actually a duet of Standing Bear singing in Ponca, and the interpreter, who is the daughter of another friend, a Ponca friend, who is singing in English in the duet. And then toward the end of the aria, both characters are joined by Bear Shield, who's a 16-year-old age, you know, about 16-year-old age son of Standing Bear, who had passed away, and they were actually going to bury, you know, the bones. They describe having the Bear Shield's bones in a box they've been hauling around on their 500-mile march. And his ghost appears in the court and joins them at the very end of the aria. And they're singing vocables.
Mm-hmm. Take a different character. Take a contrasting, well, actually, he's not exactly contrasting, General Crook. He clearly is the voice of authority here of the U.S. government. On the other hand, he's troubled by all of this because he's not absolutely clear in his conscience that what he's doing is the right thing. How'd you represent that?
Well, the obvious influences there for music or whatever are the military. He's very military. So that I pulled from ideas from that. Also, General Crook and the newspaper man, Tibbles, each of them spent a year living with the Ponca at different times, so they each have that in their background. So when I was working on the, for instance, the Tibbles and Crook duet, they meet in this, you know, bar somewhere, a pub, and they have a discussion, and General Crook is trying to convince Tibbles that they should try and take this case to court, you know, and Tibbles is, of course, you know, this is unheard of, taking, you know, having a Native American actually, you know, go to court over anything, because we weren't considered people at that point, and we didn't have the rights to a trial. So they have this whole scene together, and Crook and Tibbles each rely and banter back and forth a little bit, but their connection is the year that they each spent with the Ponca for that scene. And so what I did is I turned that scene into sort of a Ponca game song or a gaming song. So you have Tibbles, who's, you know, the wanderer who's he was adopted or left his family at an early age, and he was out on his own as a boy, and he's got this sort of folk element in his music. And then you've got General Crook, who I think was raised on a farm as well, and then joined the service at an early age and sort of wandered around as well, relocated, you know, as military people do. So you've got both of those elements, but they each share a little bit of Ponca. So I mixed a little bit of Ponca in with this duet as well.
Right, yeah. Tibbles is an interesting character as well, because he's a person who's very idealistic as a young man and sort of losing his idealism, is reluctant to get involved in this. So that, do you convey any of this as well, or is that difficult to work in when you have this kind of background to his character?
No, yeah, that's what the whole scene is about, actually, the scene. General Crook is trying to convince Tibbles to go ahead and not just settle for the status quo, but, you know, go after this one, too. You know, you worked for the abolitionists, and you've done all these other things, and, you know, work for Standing Bear, too, and I have a new idea. And he goes ahead and tells him his idea.
Right. Well, this is going to be a unique experience, undoubtedly, for opera goers. If you had the opportunity, you were standing in the lobby as these people enter, what would you like them to take away from this opera? What are you trying to deliver in the way of a message through your music?
Well, hopefully, I think for opera goers who are, you know, generally used to going to operas, I hope they come away with a sense of what it means to be Ponca and what it means to be Native American. They're going to certainly hear Ponca melodies and rhythms and see Ponca elements in the music as well as the opera. But also I'm hoping that Native Americans will come and see the opera. I don't know about you, but there are not a lot of, you know, opera goers on the reservation. But hopefully they'll be compelled, knowing the Native American history and culture, to come see the trial of Standing Bear, the opera, and somehow become, you know, interested in what operas are all about.
Well, it couldn't have come at a more opportune time because of the strain that's been in Nebraska between the state and some of the Native Americans. So it'll be interesting to see what follows. But thank you for joining us today, and good luck with the opera. You've been listening to Brent Michael Davids, composer of the music for Opera Omaha's new opera, The Trial of Standing Bear, and we will close with another piece from his Indian Killer. For our site of the week, we call to your attention a place where you can learn more about the history and culture of Native Americans. And here to tell you about that place is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
In western New Mexico, about 45 miles south of Gallup, is a place called El Morro, a white sandstone bluff that stretches 200 feet high, and in its base, a 200,000-gallon water hole that has attracted visitors for centuries. But the biggest attraction at El Morro are the thousands of historical drawings and signatures carved into the bluff's sandstone sides. Many of those date back to the ancestors of the Zuni, who built an 875-room pueblo atop El Morro in the 13th century. One corner is open to the public viewing and is well worth the mile height to the top of the bluff. Much easier to spot are the carvings left by Spanish explorers recounting discoveries and battles and detail the history of the area. In 1906, President Theodore Roosevelt designated El Morro as the nation's second national monument to prohibit further defacement of the bluff.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. 2 months from now, in February 2000, the Heard Museum in Phoenix, Arizona, will open a new exhibition called Remembering Our Indian School Days, addressing the Indian boarding school experience from the perspective of former students. The Indian boarding schools were one manifestation of the federal government's new approach in the final quarter of the 19th century to dealing with American Indian tribes. Beginning in the 1870s, the government pursued policies designed to force Native Americans to assimilate into American culture, and Indian schools were an important part of that policy. Be sure to call the Heard Museum in Phoenix for further information. And on December 14th, be sure to test your knowledge of American history, or more specifically, your knowledge of American inventions, technological breakthroughs, and engineering history on the History Channel's The Great American History Quiz, Modern Marvels. Check your local listings for the exact time. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our special show on the bicentennial of the death of George Washington. In the meantime, we will close with an aria from the opera, The Trial of Standing Bear, and invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. I see so much.